I'll be reading this morning from John chapter 18, starting with verse 33. John 18, 33. Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "You are the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you up to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Pilate therefore said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him."
I want to repeat to those that mention again, those that are visiting, we're glad that you're here. Glad that you have decided to be with us this morning, to seek us out, and to worship God. Our lesson this morning is going to, I think, dovetail rather well with what Joe preached on this last Sunday night, talking about baptism. We'll see that here towards the end of the lesson. But I'd like to begin this morning by mentioning that being an engineer, I didn't have an opportunity to take classes. Well, I had an opportunity. I did not take classes in philosophy when I was in college. Problem with philosophy is there's nothing definite about it. I can tell you that the volts produced is going to be equal to the amount of the current going through times the resistance. And that works in every case. That's Ohm's law. It's a law. Kirchhoff's got a law if you're a double E. And it works every time. But when it comes to philosophy, it's nothing really tangible. It's what everyone thinks. I kind of wish now, if I was in college and I was taking engineering classes, I could have taken courses in philosophy, and I would be interested in taking philosophy now just to see what the world teaches about that. This question or the idea of philosophy goes back a long, long time. In particular, the question that Pilate asked Jesus when Jesus stood before him. The question of just what is truth, and what Greg read to us just a few minutes ago, and this artist's idea of perhaps Pilate posing that question to Jesus, and the passage that is there in John chapter 18, saying that you're a king. That I say that I'm a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. And Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And it's a question that has puzzled mankind for some time now. You find people today that will tell you that truth is relative. Truth is to you whatever truth is. And I can have my own truth. And they don't have to necessarily be the same. And so, for those of us that are trying to identify how we need to be going, what we need to do in order to spend eternity with God, or is there even going to be an eternity to be concerned with? As we search for that truth, we sometimes run into some obstacles. And we're going to be looking at some obstacles that have been presented to us in the scriptures of where individuals were asked, were given the choice to decide just exactly what was truth in the given matter. And we're going to look at individuals to see just what it was that these individuals did wrong in looking at truth and trying to identify the truth that was presented to them. We're going to look at least two individuals and then a group of individuals that made mistakes when they were posed with what were apparently conflicting messages and how they chose to ignore those. The first one individual we're going to look at is a fellow named Zedekiah. Zedekiah was the last king of Judah. Zedekiah was the last man to sit on the throne, who was a descendant, the throne of Judah, that was a descendant of David. Zedekiah, at the time of the story that we're going to look at today here, took place, would have been in 586 B.C., but the Jews had already undergone two previous deportations prior to this. One was in 605, and the other one was in 597 B.C., and they were about to undergo a third, and it was going to be a final deportation. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had left in the first deportation. You may know these young men here by their Babylonian names, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. Daniel also had a Babylonian name, but for some reason we don't know him by that. It was Belteshazzar. And what had happened was in 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar had been leading his father's armies, had come down and had surrounded Jerusalem and had pretty well subdued it. But in the middle of consolidating all of his gains, he receives word that his father had died back in Babylon. And so, wanting to make sure that he secured the throne, that no usurper was going to take the throne away from him, he very quickly gathers up some individuals to take back as exiles from Jerusalem, among whom were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he had these four young men serve in his court as administrators. The second deportation occurred around 597, when the Jews had a little rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar, and he came back and he had to do this all over again, and he caused them to have a second deportation or exiles leave, and Ezekiel left in that deportation. In the meantime, Jeremiah remained in Jerusalem. And even after 586, when Jerusalem was completely destroyed, Nebuzaradan, who was the captain of the guard for Nebuchadnezzar, gave Jeremiah permission, freedom, to go wherever he wanted. He told him that if you want to, in Jeremiah chapter 32, he said, if you want to stay here, you can stay here. You can go join yourself with Gedaliah, who is the governor that we're leaving to rule this province, or you can go somewhere else. You can go back to Babylon with us if you want to. It's your option. And you got to ask yourself the question, why is it possible that he was given this kind of freedom? And we look no further than right here when we realize that these four young men were back there in Babylon as administrators. Daniel was arguably, perhaps, the number two man, or close to it, in the administration. Certainly he was a man of influence, so that he could get word to the army of Babylon. When you find this guy, Jeremiah, you just let him do whatever he wants. And you give him the freedom to do whatever he thinks to be appropriate. One of the more interesting things, and we see the hand of God in taking care of his people in all of this. There's just asides here for this. But one of the things to note in all of this, that as we begin to look at the passage, look at the what's told us in the scriptures, that we have Ezekiel that is in the area of the Chaldeans, and he is making prophecy after prophecy, saying the same thing that Jeremiah is saying. Jerusalem's going to fall. It's going to be destroyed. We also have a recording that of God showing Ezekiel just how corrupt the nation of Israel had become there in Judah, and how corrupt the people really were. And it makes for interesting reading as we begin to look at the book of Ezekiel. But what we have here are a couple of pieces of information that were almost certainly were presented to Zedekiah. First of all, we have Jeremiah in Jeremiah 32, where he tells Zedekiah, the king of Judah, that's you, Zedekiah, shall not escape out of the hand of the Chaldeans, but shall surely be given into the hand of the king of Babylon, and shall speak with him face to face and see him eye to eye. Meanwhile, back in area of Babylon, we have Ezekiel in chapter 12 and verse 13 of his book says, in speaking about the king, I will spread my net over him. That would be God saying, I'll spread my net over him. And he shall be taken in my snare. And I will bring him to Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans. Yet he shall not see it, and he shall die there. So here's information, and you say, well, Ezekiel's way back in Babylon. We have every reason to believe that what Ezekiel prophesied, what he wrote down, that information very much got back to Zedekiah back in Jerusalem. So he has these two pieces of information handed to him, where he says, Jeremiah says that you're going to see the king of Babylon and you're going to see him face to face. And then Ezekiel says, you're going to go to Babylon, but you're not going to see it. Which is suggestive of the fact that he's going to have his eyes put out. And so here's Zedekiah. They're saying two separate things. This guy is saying, this guy says, I'm going to see the king. And this guy says, I'm not going to see Babylon, but I'm going to go. And so at least one of these guys is a false prophet. I'm going to throw out what they have to say. Well, when we turn to 2 Kings chapter 25, we're told just exactly what happens. Even though Jeremiah had told Zedekiah, what you need to do is you need to just go out and surrender to the king. That's what you need to do. That's the only way you're going to have a good ending to this situation. Zedekiah instead decides he's going to sneak out of town in the middle of the night. And we read there in 2 Kings chapter 25 that on the ninth day, beginning verse 3, the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Then a breach was made in the city, and all the men of war fled by night and by the way of the gate between the two walls by the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were around the city. And they went in the direction of the Arabah. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from him. Then they captured the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah. and they passed sentence on him. They slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes and put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him in chains and took him to Babylon. And there you have it. Both instances, both men who prophesied, turns out they were both right. There was no contradiction at all, though Zedekiah may have perceived there to be one. And as the story indicates, the last thing Zedekiah saw before his eyesight was taken from him, was the sight of his sons being killed in front of him. And he was taken to Babylon, and that's where he died. So Zedekiah almost certainly felt like he had, I found a contradiction here, and I can just ignore what God's been telling me here that I need to do. And I'll just go do what I want to do. And he did, and he suffered the consequences. We have another individual. This fellow named Ahab. Some of you probably remember this fellow. He's king of Israel. And we have the story of, in 1 Kings 21, of how he had decided he wanted the vineyard of Naboth. And he goes to Naboth and says, hey, I'll buy your land. And Naboth says, no, I'm not allowed to do that. This is my family land. God says, I'm not allowed to sell you this land. And so Ahab goes back to the castle and pretty much sulks over. He's upset. And his wife says, wait a minute, are you king or not? We common vernacular say, you're a man or a mouse. So she takes matters in her own hands, and she arranges for Naboth to be killed. And so Ahab goes out to inspect the vineyard. He's going to be able to acquire this land now. He wants this vineyard for his gardens, for his own purposes. And Elijah goes out there to meet him. And here's what Elijah tells Ahab. God tells Elijah that you're going to say to him, thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick your own blood. And in effect, what that's saying is you're going to die here, and you're going to die in a terrible fashion. You're going to die in a dishonorable manner. Well, time goes on, a good 3 years to be exact. Previously to this, during the reign of Omri, you had had Ben-Hadad from Syria come down, and he captured several cities that had belonged to Israel. One of them was Ramoth-Gilead. Ahab had fought a battle with Ben-Hadad, actually the son of Ben-Hadad, who's also known as a Ben-Hadad, which was an honorary title like Pharaoh. And he had defeated him and captured him, and Ben-Hadad says, look, I'll tell you what, I'll give you all the cities back that my father had taken from your father. Ahab says, you got a deal. You're free to go. And he lets him go. So now, after some time, Ahab says, you know, he's never made good on his deal to where he said he'd give me these cities, one of which was Ramoth-Gilead. We need to go up there and do something about that. At the same time he decides to do this, Jehoshaphat, who's king of Judah, is up visiting there in Samaria. And Ahab says, hey, would you come help me? And Jehoshaphat says, look, my men are as your men. My chariots are like your chariots. Certainly, we'll be glad to help you. How about if we inquire, though, of a prophet of the Lord before we go do this? And so they said, fine. They brought in a bunch of men. And they all said, oh, yes, go do this. This is going to work. You'll succeed. And there's something about this that Jehoshaphat doesn't really like. He says, yeah, but can we get a real prophet? Is there not somebody we can really get here? So Ahab says, yeah, there's this guy, but every time I bring him in, he doesn't have anything good to say. And then so I'm really reluctant to do that. And Jehoshaphat says, let's do it anyway. So they bring him in. His name's Micaiah. They bring him in. And at first he says, oh yeah, you'll succeed. And they said, wait, tell that there's something about the Hebrew there that they understood he was really making fun of them and he was mocking them. And they said, tell us the truth. He says, okay, you go up, you're going to die. And he tells them that. They're it's the next chapter after chapter 21. It's there in chapter 22. And verse 20 there, he said that he explains that what's going on is the Lord wants Ahab to go up so he'll die at Ramoth-Gilead. And so he winds up sending deceiving spirits to convince Ahab to go. And there's a lot of lessons just in that. But we won't go into them. But rather, we're going to focus on the fact that here you had Micaiah telling Ahab, you know, the Lord wants you to go up because you're going to die. And you're going to go. And so this is what I want you to do, Ahab. You just go. We'll just tell you that everything's going to be okay. And that way we'll get you to go up. And then he says there in verse 20, when the Lord said, who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And he goes on to tell how there's this one spirit says, I'll go tell all of his prophets that he needs to go up and that will work. And in verse 23, Micaiah now says, now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets. The Lord has declared disaster for you. So here Ahab has two conflicting messages. This guy Elijah told him he's going to die there in Samaria, in effect. That's what he understood Elijah to say. When Elijah said, see right here where the dogs are licking up the blood of Naboth, that's where they're going to lick up your blood too. And now he's got Micaiah saying, if I go up to Ramoth-Gilead, I'm going to die there. And this is something to point out. This is a map that illustrates, here's Samaria, here's Ramoth-Gilead. This was not right next door. This was a long ways away. This was probably a couple of days' journey at least just to get over there. And yet, somehow, one guy says, I'm going to die here. Another one says, I'm going to die here. So what I'm going to do is I'll just do whatever I want. That's exactly what he did. He said, I want to go to Ramoth-Gilead, so that's what I'm going to do. And that's and so he did. And so how did things turn out? Well, we look there in 1 Kings chapter 22, and we begin to see how it worked out that both Micaiah and both Elijah were correct. Beginning in verse 29 of 1 Kings 22, the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. But notice, some of what Micaiah had said, Ahab took to heart. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you wear your robes. Just in case there's something to what Micaiah says, we'll still trick God here. And the king of Israel disguised himself and went into battle. Now the king of Syria had commanded the 32 captains of his chariots, fight with neither small nor great, but only with the king of Israel. And when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, they said, it is surely the king of Israel. So they turned to fight against him. And Jehoshaphat cried out. And when the captains of the chariots saw it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. But a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel between the scale armor and the breastplate. Therefore he said to the driver of his chariot, turn around and carry me out of the battle, for I am wounded. And the battle continued that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot facing the Syrians until at evening he died. And the blood of the wound flowed into the bottom of the chariot, and about sunset a cry went out, went through with the army, every man to his city and every man to his country. And the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria. And they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. And so that's how the story ends, of how both Elijah and Micaiah were right. So you had Ahab presented with two apparently conflicting ideas, and he decides, well, I'm just going to do whatever I want to anyway. And he paid for it with his life. We have another example that we can point to very briefly here this morning. Scribes and the Pharisees, you can also toss in, I guess, the Sadducees. When we look in the Old Testament scriptures, there are all kinds of descriptions of the Messiah. There are all kinds of these are just some of the ways that the Messiah was described in the Old Testament. Wonderful, Counselor, Prince of Peace, Man of Sorrows, Emmanuel, the Anointed Son, Son of Man, the Good Shepherd, the Holy One, the Suffering Servant there of Isaiah chapter 53, the Son of God and the King of Glory. Some of these are contradictory. And what the Jews wound up doing was to look at some of them and they just threw some of them out. That's not really the Messiah. That really can't be the Messiah. Well, who's he talking about? Well, I don't know. But it can't be the Messiah. And they wound up only picking those that they really liked, so that when they began to consider the Messiah, all they would consider was, well, he's going to be setting up this kingdom here on earth, and he's going to rule with absolute perfect justice, and everything's going to be wonderful. If it didn't fit that narrative, they tossed it out. So when the Messiah did come, this is what happened. As a result, Jesus didn't fit their narrative. Jesus didn't fit the idea that they had of the Messiah. So they decided the only thing they could do was to crucify him. All the while not realizing that it was just exactly what God had foretold was going to happen. Those are some examples of individuals that we could look at in the scriptures who were faced with what would be apparently conflicting ideas. And they made the wrong choice in their pursuit of truth, if there was any pursuit of truth at all. We're going to look at an individual now that was given the exact same challenge. Exact same difficulty, but he made the right choice. And that's going to be looking at Abraham. And this is brought out for us in Hebrews chapter 11, rather briefly. We're going to look at this in a little bit more detail here. First of all, Abraham was told that through Isaac he'd be the father of many nations. We're told this in several places. You could go back to Genesis chapter 15, where Isaac isn't really named, but we get a little bit later in Genesis 17, where he is named. And God is talking to Abraham about his wife. He said, I will bless her, Sarah, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings of people shall come from her. And then three verses later, in verse 19, after, by the way, Abraham had laughed, saying, I'm so old and she's old, there's no way it's going to happen. And God says, oh no, Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you'll give him, you'll call his name Isaac. So between this and the earlier promise that God had made to Abraham that his descendants will be like the stars of the sky, the sands of the sea, against that backdrop that Abraham had in the way of a promise from God, he was told, go sacrifice your son. Genesis chapter 22, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I shall tell you. Genesis 22 and 2. Think about this. God, you told me I'm going to have, Isaac's going to be the one through whom I'm going to have all kinds of descendants, and yet go kill the kid? And any of us that are parents will understand exactly how easy it would have been for Abraham to have said, this second one's nuts. It makes no sense. And so I'm going to just toss it out altogether. Because, you know, after all, I've got this promise here. And I'm going to ignore this directive that God has given me. Abraham didn't do that. Abraham did not do that, and instead he winds up taking his son and he starts to do exactly what God had told him to do. And the explanation given to us there in Hebrews chapter 11 is that he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. I don't think there's a parent in here that would have really had much criticism for Abraham if he had said, no, there's got to be something wrong with this second command. So I'm just God, just forget it. It's not going to happen. We don't have that. We have instead Abraham. And one of the reasons why he is revered and looked upon so highly, why he is in what we would call the hall of faith there in Hebrews chapter 11, is because he was willing to say, yeah, I've got this and that, and you know, they don't make sense, but I've still got to do this. I've still got to do what I was told to do, even though it doesn't make sense. God will work it out somehow. And so, what we're left with then is the illustration is, which was true? Which was true for Abraham? Your seed through Isaac shall be as numberless as the stars? Or go to the mountain and sacrifice your son Isaac? Which one was true? Well, it turns out that the answer was both. So we take this and we look at some applications here for us today. Here's one. In Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 8, by grace you are saved through faith. That's a verse that's popular with many of our religious friends. But then we also read in James chapter 2 and verse 24, you see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. Wait a minute. Which of these is true? Which of these can possibly, they're apparently contradictory. Well, the answer is that both are true. How can they both be true? Well, the answer is absolutely. We are saved by grace. I don't want anyone to leave here this morning thinking there's a thing you can do to merit salvation. There's not a thing you can possibly do. I don't care how many good works you might decide to do. I don't care how many good favors you decide to bestow. You don't have the ability to erase one sin from your soul. And it's only because of the grace of God that we have any hope whatsoever. But at the same time, we need to recognize that what James is teaching us there is that we can't just simply sit back and say, well, I believe, and that's enough. As he points out, even the angels believe and they tremble. Or devils believe and tremble. There are entities that we know of that are going to spend eternity in hell, and they believe. It will avail them nothing. What God demands of us is obedient faith, not just simply faith. Here's a similar example, and it's related to it. The wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. Romans chapter 6 and verse 23. Again, a passage that's really famous, or not famous, but revered and well-liked among those that are religious friends. But then we have a passage that just seems to be diametrically opposed to it. Baptism now saves you, Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 21. Which is it? Is the gift of salvation just the free gift of God? There you go. Or rather, is there something else involved in our salvation? And so the answer is, it's both. It's not just one or the other, it's both. And what we have to do when we're confronted with passages that seemingly are contradictory is to look for ways for both of them to be true, because God said both of them. And we understand this when dealing with many other passages. For instance, recently in our Wednesday night class, the Sermon on the Mount, we encountered Matthew chapter 7, verse 1. Judge not, that ye be not judged. And yet we pointed out there are other passages, even from our Lord himself, John chapter 7 and verse 24. Judge with righteous judgment. How do we reconcile these? Well, we did in the class. We figured out, okay, this is what Jesus must have meant here in Matthew 7, and here's what he meant here in John 7. And we worked that out. Some of you can maybe think of other examples that we've run across in our day-to-day Bible studies, that we'll find a passage that over here it says this, and something else that seems to teach something the opposite. Which one is true? Well, the answer is, they're both true. And it works the same way, the same principle is true when we approach even passages that are seemingly difficult. Which one is true? They're both true. And yet, unfortunately, sometimes, and I'll cast a really broad net, it's true in the church as well, but it's also true in the religious world. We'll encounter a passage that I don't like what that says. Either I don't understand it, I don't agree with it, I can't get my arms around it, so I just throw it out. That can't be, that just can't be true at all. It can't mean what it says. And so we just toss it out of the Bible altogether, and we latch on to that one verse that we really like, and we hang our hat on that. That's not actively pursuing truth. That's not having a love for the truth. One of the things to note is obvious from this in our lesson here this morning. Sometimes God masks truth with seeming contradictions, and he leaves it up to us to go and diligently seek for them. that he'll sometimes mask truth in a way that if you really want to know what the truth is, you're going to have to work hard for it. He doesn't just lay out a whole list of things, say, okay, you need to know this and this and this and this. It's not looking at electrical engineering textbook and say, you got Ohm's law, Kirchhoff's law, you got all these different ideas. Instead, so many times it's like Ezekiel, not like Ezekiel, like Zedekiah, like Ahab, being given contradictory things that we find in the scriptures, and we have to go looking for ways to harmonize them and make them both true. And related to that, as we note, we read in Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 23, buy the truth and sell it not. Well, I'll tell you, and this again is another period of time we can spend on it. And we've mentioned this from time to time, but usually the cost to buy the truth, usually it's pretty high. And you say, well, Randy, what are you talking about? Well, it may mean we have to swallow our pride and admit, yes, this position that I've taken for so many years, I was wrong on that. And I need to change now and agree that, yes, that's no longer truth. And you say, that's hard. That's just, there's no two ways about it. That's hard. May it mean that we have to, it may cost us admitting that someone we love or respect is wrong. I've heard stories of individuals being taught the gospel, and they respond to the person teaching them saying, do you realize you're teaching my grandparents into hell? And they would refuse to obey the gospel based on that alone. How sad. And yet people will do that. That it's more important to them to cling to that than it is to that concept, because it would mean if they were to agree that truth was being presented to them, that someone they love, or maybe an elder, maybe a preacher, someone that they respect, that they're wrong. Or sometimes it may cost us time and effort. I heard a story one time, illustration of a young man that went and heard a gospel preacher, and he was impressed so much with the preacher's knowledge of the scriptures. And after the sermon, he went up to the preacher. He said, sir, he said, I'd give my life if I knew the Bible as well as you. And he turned to the young man, he says, son, that's just about what it cost me. We want Bible knowledge, yes, but we don't want to spend the time it takes to acquire that knowledge. We want somehow to maybe just open our mind, pour it into a funnel, and we just have it with very little effort, whatever. You won't get a good knowledge of the scriptures with no effort. You'll get a return on whatever you invest in the scriptures. Cost of truth usually is really high. Finally, we serve an awesome God. We serve a God whose word is absolute truth. You can count on every word. And Jesus made that statement in John chapter 17, verse 17, where he's praying for the disciples. He said, sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. We serve a God that you can trust, you can rely, you can count on every word that we have from him. No disputing it whatsoever. Are you here this morning? And you've come to recognize, yes, indeed, I need to turn loose of some concepts that I've had. I need to yield myself to God. I need to make myself right with God. And I need to do that by putting on my Lord in baptism this morning. We want to encourage you to do that. We want you to seriously, we're going to sing a song that's designed to get you to try and get you to consider the situation in which you're in. Maybe you're here this morning and you've done that. You are a Christian. You obey the gospel, but you've drifted away. We want to encourage you as well if you need the prayers of the congregation. There are things we can do to help you to overcome whatever it is that's troubling you in your life. We ask you to let us know by coming to the front as we stand and sing this song that's been selected.